Okay, so I'd like to get started. Thanks. How's that? Better? Okay. So we're going to do this presentation, and I did get one suggestion for a topic, which was LIGO, which is an interferometer dedicated to gravitational waves. Deliana, are you here? No? Okay. I emailed her back saying, very cool project, but it has to do with E&M, and we didn't come to closure, so it's not on the list. There are things that involve E&M with LIGO, but I need to understand what you might be thinking in order to put it on the list. At any rate, is that in focus to you? You all right with that? Okay. Yep, that's what I'm going to try to do here, I think. No, all right. No, wrong one. There, that's what I was after. Okay, so I'm going to hand out, I guess it's the same list I already handed out. What I would like you to do is next to the different topics, I want you to write in ascending order of your preference of the topics that you would like to do. Give me 5 of them, okay? And I would like you to sort of put the your preferences in circles off to the side. And the problem is if you write them in order over here and half the people do this, then it starts getting confusing when I'm going through and trying to sort things out. So if you just all do it one way, it'll be easy for me. Yes?
Ascending order means that the one we want most.
The one you want most is number one.
Okay.
And the one you'd like next, number two, and only give me about 5 of them. And if there is someone here or several that you really want to work with, feel free to put their names there. No promises, because if they put other people and it turns into this ridiculous matrix, I mean, I'll try to accommodate your preferences as best I can, but... okay, so... Huh? Yeah.
Give it to us.
Yes,
that's a thought. So I would like these at the end of class on Thursday or today or sometime in between if you want to slip it under my office door. But Thursday evening, I'll try to sort them out and come up with the groups and let you know what they are. And then we'll talk a little bit more about where to go from there. But basically, once you have your groups, what I would like you to do is to set up a time and meet and talk a little bit about what your strategy is, what you're thinking about for that particular topic. And then I would like to meet with you as a group and chat with you about what you're thinking and give you some ideas and maybe some things to watch out for about that. And I'll also tell you more about how the evaluation is going to work as we get along. Any questions about this right now? Yes?
You've mentioned this already, but this as a reminder. About approximately how large are the groups going to be?
I think I'm aiming to have 6 to 8 groups in this class, and I've forgotten how many class sections. We can only do 2 presentations per class. So it depends on whether I held out 4 or 3 in the syllabus, and I forget which it was.
How many students are...
Well, we have about 45 students in the class, so divide that by 6 or 8, and that gives you the size.
What do you mean by animals and magnets?
Sharks have a really refined sense for detecting electric fields. Electromagnetism? Yeah. No, magnetism. Then you also, there are bacteria that actually have magnetic, they actually have bits of iron, and they can orient themselves, and birds. I mean, so there's a lot of electromagnetism out there besides just light that animals can detect, and it's sort of a neat topic. Anything else? Okay. All right, so last time we were sort of finished up what we were going to do in relativity. And Einstein's paper on special relativity is, I guess you can't really read this, but it's basically in German on the electrodynamics of moving bodies. And to give you a sense of how that works, if we have two charges and they're stationary with respect to us, then the force between them we would interpret as purely electrostatic. If we have the same physical situation, except we now observe it as we run past, then if I haven't canceled the charges, you may still have an electrostatic or electric force between these two charges, but you will also have these currents, and we would actually interpret this charge between them as a magnetic force. So it's very clear that somehow within electromagnetism there is a very deep relationship between electricity. Well, okay, so I already say it. When I say electromagnetism, there's a very deep relationship between electricity and magnetism, and relativity is the area that really deeply elucidates it. We're not going to do any more with that. That's something that will be a core piece of what you will see sort of toward the end of your next course in electricity and magnetism. Presumably you'll see some of that. And it's really quite beautiful. We will actually see a deep relationship between electricity and magnetism, but without relativity corrections done properly. But it still works well. That's something done by Maxwell long before Einstein came along. So that takes us to magnetism, which is really our next topic. And in the world of magnetism, the starting place for me is Lorentz force law, which is the force on a particle in what we think of as electric and or magnetic fields. So again, without elaborating so much, you're now pretty used to the electric field. So we say, if there is something that feels a magnetic force, well, it's because there is a magnetic field in the space that surrounds it. So a bar magnet has a magnetic field around it. And as we saw in demos last time, if I have a current, in fact, it will create a magnetic field in the space around it. If there is a magnetic field, and if we have an electric field, or either or, the Lorentz force law is the thing that describes the force on the charged particle. So F equals QE, you've seen before, and then this is the magnetic piece. F is the force is equal to Q, V cross V. And this cross product, of course, makes things a little different and a little less intuitive than it is with electrostatics typically. So I went through this last time verbally, but just to remind you, to evaluate the cross product between two vectors A and B, you do it by evaluating this determinant, which is basically given by taking this first piece up here and then multiplying it by this times that minus this times that. And then for the second term, you put in a minus sign here. You take, I'm missing one, I'm sorry. So the first piece is this, and then you take this times that minus this times that. This is the second one, and it comes in with a minus sign, and the third one is similar to the first, except you're multiplying this by those four. So get in the habit of doing that. The intuition of the cross product is you're taking, it's a vector, the magnitude of it is going to be at right angles to the two vectors that you're using in the cross product, and the magnitude is basically the magnitude of one of these times the component of the other that is at right angles to it, or vice versa. Okay, so that would work out to be A times B times C. So, or you can get the magnitude up this way. All this actually is more than the magnitude because it's the actual vector decomposition. All right, so the issue with this is it means that if we have a direction for a magnetic field and we have a direction for velocity for a particle, the force is actually at right angles to it. So all of a sudden things are going to go 3D in a way that they haven't really yet. So magnetism is sometimes going to be a little bit stranger to people when they first hit it. Um, So just to give you a flavor for that, I have here, back in the days before there were flat screen TVs, in fact, back before we had nice color monitors, this is basically a television setup, a cathode ray tube. And the way a cathode ray tube works is you'll have a filament that is hot, and it's excited, which means the electrons are not really held very tightly. And you can now put that with an electric field so that the electrons basically are pulled off the filament. So you'll get a little beam of electrons accelerated in the electric field through a little bit of a potential difference. You can then basically have a hole through which the electrons will go, okay? And so you'll have this little electron beam. And what you can do is send that beam and impinge it on a phosphorus coated piece of glass, and it will emit green light where it gets excited by the electrons and they come cascading back in the atomics. And so that's what you're seeing here. So now the game is, if you want to do something interesting with this, is that you can use electric and magnetic fields to control where this beam goes. And in fact, you can even take this beam and oscillate it in lines going across and modulate its intensity, and that gives you a black and white TV, basically, right? So that's all fine and nice. Here's our beam of electrons is just moving like so, right? So we have a velocity vector, which is this way. Now I have a magnet, just a regular bar magnet. And you can assume in a bar magnet that it has magnetic field lines that emanate from a north pole and go around and come back to the south pole. That's sort of how you can visualize the field lines. So if I were to take this magnet and approach that beam of electrons, I'll be coming in with a magnetic field basically in the direction of approach for this magnet. And look at what happens. If I come with the magnetic field flipped and sine, it goes the other way. Right? The cross product should be that way, right? If A cross B is this way, then if I flip the sine of A cross B is going to be the other direction. Right? If I come down like this, it goes to the right. If I come the other way, it goes to the left. Right? Is that cool? Are you a believer now? Yeah. Do you believe? Let me think what else I can do with this. Right? You can have lots of fun with these. Anyway, so Lorentz force law. VQV cross V. It's actually very real. Of course, which came first, right? Nature does that, so the mathematics was invented to describe this. The cross product gives you this natural way of, if I have this way and that way, I get something that goes off this way, and it fits beautifully in magnetism, right? So the Lorentz force law came about, of course, after people were trying to describe what they were seeing in nature. So let's imagine for a moment that we have a magnetic field that is uniform, and this magnetic field is coming out of the board. So what you see are the tips of the arrows of the vectors coming out at you. If the magnetic field were going into the board, I would draw X's, okay? So everything's going to go 3D now, so that's the convention that I'll use. So just get used to that. So we have a uniform B coming out. Let us imagine that we now have wrong color. We have a particle which is moving with a velocity at this moment here. Okay? If V is this way, then to do the cross product, there are different ways to do it. And I don't really care which method you use, but I want you to do it consistently. And I want everyone, I'll turn this way. Raise your right hand. Okay? All right. We're going to do this before the exam. If you want, you can put a big R on the back of this one. Because if you do the right hand rule with your left hand, you get exactly the wrong sign on everything. Okay? Now, some people will do the left hand rule if they see that there's a negative charge in the problem. Very dangerous business. You get used to doing that left hand, you can get in trouble fast, okay? I suggest you always use your right hand, all right? And there are different ways you may have learned to do it. I'm going to explain to you the way that I think of doing it. All right. I picture the plane in which the two vectors are. I take my right hand, okay? And if I get confused, I always remember that I write with my right hand. All right. If you're left-handed, you'll have to figure a different way around that, but whatever. All right, so you take the fingers of your right hand, and you put them along the first vector. It's QV cross B, and it matters whether it's A cross B or B cross A, okay? That gives you different directions. So V cross B. So I put the fingers, the four fingers, these are fingers, that's a thumb, right? The four fingers along V, all right? And then in the plane which the two vectors form, which in this case is this plane, right? Because I've got B coming out that way and V this way. So I take my fingers and I point them along the first vector, and then I curl them into the direction of the second vector in that plane in the direction of the smallest angle between the two vectors, okay? Which is not this angle, it is this angle. So that orients you like so, you curl them like that, and your thumb points in the direction of the cross product. So in this case, there will be a force on this charge at this instant, which is directly down, okay? I've known people who have a game they play with these fingers, right? You may have learned that. I've heard of other things. Actually, I do have... Should I tell this story? I do have a story that will probably sear it into your minds. You can also imagine that you have a screw, right, with the head right here and a screwdriver like this, okay? And if you imagine if you want to screw this in to something, you take it and you turn it like this. So that would take a vector A, curl it into B, and you go in the direction that the screw moves. Okay? So you can think of it that way. Now, I had only heard that when I was in college. My professor, when I was in general physics, was explaining this to the class. And to paint the picture right, in that class, I was sitting in the back, and there was a brilliant young lady who was also fabulous. I thought she was very good looking. And so I would sit in the back, and when I was bored in physics, I would just watch Patty. And, Patty's some great organic chemist now and everything. So in addition to brains, she was just beautiful to me at the time. And she was also very flighty, very ditzy. She just was sort of, and so the professor's telling this story, and he was really quite the dweeb. And at any rate, she was confused and asking, and he's trying to explain it, and And he goes, Patty, it's just like screwing. You've screwed before, right? And she's just like, whoosh. And of course, all of us guys in the back thought this was one of the most funny things that had ever been said in the history of mankind. So, at any rate, there's a story. Whenever you get confused about the cross product, just remember Patty Eller, and you should be good. Okay, at least that works for me. So, all right. So if we do the cross product right, then this thing has a force, which at that instant is down, like so. Okay. Now, what's going to happen is in the next moment, this thing is going to move, but because it has a force down this way, there's an acceleration down, which means it's going to actually have a force on it, and it'll cause it to curve. So if we imagine what happens a moment later, the velocity vector will change because there's an acceleration. So this thing will... I should probably use a different color. Yikes. Okay. So this thing begins to move like so, and now we have it at this point, but now it should be red again. Oh, good God. And it's going to be moving like this. Now if we look at it, put your fingers along V, B is straight up, which... fingers along V... B is straight up, which means the force is going to be like so, or right here, you put your fingers along V, B is coming out. You'll find the force is now headed again this way. So what you'll see is because this force is always in, and the magnitude never changes, in this problem where you have a constant B field, you'll end up with circular motion. So this thing is going to end... you're going to end up with a situation where it goes nominally in a circle, but it didn't because I can't draw. But Microsoft can fix that, hopefully. Okay. All right. Sometimes it's just not worth it. So we have the thing going in a circle V, and then we're going to have a centripetal force toward the center, F, and the magnitude of F is equal to QV cross B in a uniform magnetic field. So you'll have this thing moving in a circle. If, in fact, the initial condition, if the magnetic field is up here, for example, we're looking at in the plane that is perpendicular to the magnetic field. If there is a degree of freedom, if it has some motion in going up or down, so outside of the plane, it's an independent problem. So you'll have the circular motion superimposed, so the perpendicular component to B will form circular motion, and then the non-perpendicular component will have no magnetic force on it, and you'll have that velocity unadjusted. So what'll happen is you'll end up with this helix. Okay? So that's what happens when you go to three dimensions. But I'm sure I'll give you a problem. If I don't do it in homework, I promise it'll come on the exam. Okay. So we have centripetal force F, which is equal to mv squared over r, because that's what happens with circular motion, and I hope you're comfortable with that. That's going to be equal in magnitude to qvb. The cross product is already taken into account with the directions, and sine theta is 90 degrees in this problem because it's... I mean, theta is 90 degrees in this problem because it's at right angles. So that means that the radius of the circle is equal to m times v over q times b. Okay? So if you want to design a particle accelerator that's in a circular form, this is a way you calculate the radius you need for building the tunnel. I mean, it's basically that simple. And in fact, early particle accelerators fundamentally use this. There's a type of particle accelerator. Oops, not what I wanted. So there's an early type of particle accelerator which is known as a cyclotron. And in fact, they may still be used for when you need relatively low energy acceleration. But the idea in a cyclotron was to make two halves of a magnet, or two magnetic This would be the top view from the side. What you would see is this. So what you have is a magnet here and a magnet here, such that you create a uniform magnetic field going down. So from the top, for example, we can have these are supposed to be sort of uniformly spaced. So you start out with a particle like an electron, or let's start a proton because people tend to accelerate those more. So we start out with a positive charge right here, and a proton then in this gap, there's no magnetic field. And so the positive charge is accelerated across the gap. Then it enters a region where there's no electric field, but there's a magnetic field, and we have the velocity going this way, and the magnetic field going in, so V cross B gives us a force off this direction. So what happens is in the uniform magnetic field, this thing will move as if it's on a semicircle until it reaches this point. And when it reaches that point, just as it goes through, you flip the charge on these two surfaces so that this now becomes positive and this becomes negative. So it's accelerated across the gap again. And then it has a higher momentum because it has a higher momentum. The radius will increase for the circle as you go through the cyclotron piece. So you're going to move like this, and now you have an increased radius. And then you flip the charge again. So you now come through, and now you have an increased radius. You come through, and you have an increased radius. I don't know. So eventually it comes out, and you have a gain. So, yeah, there are four pieces. So these are called Ds, and each D basically looks like two bar magnets where you have this uniform region between them, very big uniform plates. So, of course, that's part of the problem. These are big magnets. So you can only do this up to certain energies. I don't know what the limit is. But we actually used to have a cyclotron here at the university. There was, back in the day when we were doing physics at relatively low energies, any department that was worth its salt had its own little accelerator, and people, you know, so the particle physicists actually did experiments on campus. Nowadays, what happens is you dig a tunnel that's a circle, and around the circle you basically run a string of magnets. So it's not a perfect circle, but what happens is in the magnets, as you accelerate, so now you have the particles that you inject them because you have some other little accelerator that starts now. It might be something more like the synchrotron or whatever. And you have the magnetic field set so that they'll move in a circle as they go around. And then when they get to a certain point, you have a piece here which we call an RF cavity. Stands for a radio frequency cavity. And it's a cavity that is set up so that it has an electric field that oscillates back and forth like this. And you have the timing of that oscillation set so just as the particles come through, they get a kick in the right direction by the electric field. So every time the particles come around, they get a kick. So you have to have everything synchronized. And in fact, this is called a synchrotron. So the accelerator at Fermi Lab, for example, the Tevatron, is a synchrotron. And what happens is you inject the particles, and then every time they come around, you give them a kick, which means you're accelerating them in a small section of the accelerator every time they come around, and you have to ramp the magnetic field up in order to keep them inside this ring, which you have to do because you have only that tunnel. So what limits you here is the size of the tunnel and the strength of the magnetic field that you can get. So it becomes a big deal to create very powerful magnets that have a perfectly well-known magnetic field, which you can ramp quickly and ramp down constantly. So this is sort of the science that limits how big an accelerator you can get.
Yeah. How do they do the linear one? Is that just an electric field?
No, it's actually a string of RF cavities, and we're going to get there. But what an RF cavity is, it's basically a standing electromagnetic wave. So we're not there yet, but it's very much like in mechanics, you have these standing waves on a string, which you've probably seen when you have a wave going this way and a wave coming back, and they interfere constructively, and you get these standing waves. So you can do the same thing inside a conducting cavity, so that you basically have this electromagnetic wave. And if I just think about the electric piece, and we're going to get to how all this works, the electric piece is just oscillating, and you just have it timed right. So in a linear one, you do the same thing, but as it goes faster and faster, you have to have the electric field timed just right in the different cavities so that it gets a kick the whole way through. So it's okay, so that's basically the way particle accelerators work. If you're into chemistry or something, there's a device often used called a mass spectrometer. These actually can be used for lots of interesting things. Low-energy nuclear accelerators, this guy named Harry Gove, who died a few years ago, was a faculty member here, who took a small piece of the Shroud of Turin and did an analysis of did a carbon-14 dating by counting the number of carbon nuclei in this small piece, by basically vaporizing the stuff and then sending it through the accelerator and using it as a mass spectrometer. So the idea of the mass spectrometer, which is more typically used in chemistry, so you take some sample of crud that you don't know what it is, and you basically vaporize it and accelerate it through a potential difference, and that will mean different types of crud. I'm using crud here in a very technical sense. So you have lots of different types of chemical crud, or you want to know what it is. If you vaporize or you burn it, okay, you're going to get particular types of charged fragments coming out of that. And a different type of crud will give you different charged fragments. So it's a way of doing analytic identification work on substances. So you have your organic crud. It could be a piece of Shroud of Turin if you want. And you accelerate these bits after vaporizing them through a potential difference. Then they enter a region of uniform magnetic field and will go through in a circle. And you can then detect every piece of crud that hits along here. And they will have varying radii depending on their charge to mass ratio. So we've already seen this. This is what you get from a circle. You set the force of magnetic force is the centripetal force. So that's equal to the centripetal. I'm sorry, this is the centripetal force. So this equation works. Solve for M over Q, basically. M over Q. So the kinetic energy, if you know how much you have what potential you put the thing through, because I have the different V's. I have a big V, big case V for potential here. You can solve for what V is in terms of the potential that you put it through and the mass over charge ratio, and you substitute that in for V, and you can end up with an expression for the mass of whatever the crud is, or the mass per charge ratio, which is typically how people look at it. And what you'll note, if I pull the Q over, I have a constant E, a constant B. X is what I've defined to be is basically 2 times the radius in this particular problem. So I've defined this distance X is from the entrance point here to where you hit the detector. And the detector is set up to basically do a count whenever some ion hits it. It just gives you a flash of however many ions you get at that radius, sort of gives you an intensity at that radius. So if you were to take this molecule, for example, and burn it, you'll get a lot of different pieces that can come off of this, and then you send them through the mass spec and you'll get a relative intensity of these different mass to charge ratios. So if you plot the mass to charge ratio, you'll get, and these are the sort of the relative intensity, you'll get these various peaks. And so different substances will give you a different spectrum here, so you can actually use it to identify substances. So it's useful stuff. Any questions on that kind of stuff? All right. So if you want to have real fun with this stuff, then what you want to do find what it is I'm looking for here. Then you go to the applet that I'm going to put on the web. And what I have is a little particle gun that will shoot a particle of a given charge. In this case, it's -1. Here we have a region of a uniform magnetic field that's coming out at you. So if I shoot a particle with negative charge, we have V, curl it into B, the force should be down, except it's a negative charge, so you flip it. So that it should circle up. So let's now fire once. Is that cool? All right, so now I'll fire repeatedly so we can see what happens. And now I'm going to make the magnetic field stronger. So what happens, of course, is the radius is reduced. As I go make it weaker, then the radius of the circle is less, right? Go to 0. You should have no radius of the circle. Flip the sign of B. I haven't changed the sign. It's good, right? You may frown now, but just wait. Oh, yeah, so now you can trap them. Yeah. So we can also create strange regions here. And, oh, I don't know. Let's see. I can increase the velocity, change the charge. How do I want to do this? Change the angle a bit. So the velocity is high. I want to reduce the strength of the field. So not that much. And now, oops, wrong one. Oh, I was trying to, anyway, there are ways you can trap them. So you can play with this, but the idea is to get a feeling for how the magnetic field and moving charges work. This kind of, so I'll put this applet up on a link in the class website. I haven't played with this in a while. Boy, that didn't work. Okay, I'm sorry. Okay. I'm sorry. I'll quit. I promise. Okay, so you're welcome to play with that. Just be careful how much time you lose. You do want to actually do the problem. Okay. All right. So we are looking at free charges and magnetic fields. Of course, charges can also move inside wires. So if we imagine that we have a wire, sort of a cross section of which I show here, and we have a current moving in that wire, then you can imagine that the current, they're moving particles. The way to do this is to forget the fact that moving particles are really electrons. Just take that little bit of information and throw it away unless the problem tells you explicitly to worry about it. You want to think of it as moving charges that are positive for all of the conventions. So if we have a current going to the right here and I have a magnetic field in this region of space which is into the board, then you're going to have V cross V. You have a force on this wire straight up. So you expect a magnetic force on a current carrying wire, and we need to be able to sort of determine that in terms of the field of the current, right? But the current, you can think of it as being made up of a bunch of charges. So let's assume that we have charges all of the same charge and that they move with a certain velocity through the wire, which we'll call a drift velocity, or V sub D. Cross B. And then we have a lot of these charges. So let's assume that we have n charges per unit volume. And what we really want to do to get the total force is to take this for a single charge, will be the charge times its drift velocity cross B, where B is a vector. Multiply that by the number of total charges in that wire. And so a way to do that is to take the charges per unit volume, which is some sort of characteristic of the wire, and multiply it by the cross-sectional area times the length of the wire that you're dealing with. Right. Now, if we think about what current is, current is equal to the number of charges that you have times the number of charges per unit volume times the charge times the drift velocity times the cross-sectional area. So if we this is a velocity, so this is meters per second, a meters, this is in length, times area, that's a volume. Number of charges per unit volume times a volume times the charge is going to basically give you the amount of charge passing a cross-sectional area per second, which is what we think of as a current. So if we know that that's current, then the force on the wire is equal to the length of the wire that you're considering times the current, if you want to think of the current as a vector. It will have a magnitude, it can have a direction. Think of current as a vector, cross B. Or you can imagine thinking of the current as a magnitude, and you can think of sort of take the length that you're considering in your wire and get its direction from the direction of the current and call that a vector. Sometimes this is written as I times L cross B. They really are equivalent, but which one you sort of use mentally depends on how the problem is set up sometimes. You okay with this? So this would be the Lorentz force on a wire. And in this case, you're ignoring the electric field piece on the wire unless you have some net charge on it. Typically, for these types of problems, you consider the wire as uncharged and you just have a moving current in it. So you have the same number of positive charges. You have negative charges inside the wire, and it's the positive charges that are moving. Are you okay with that? All right, so this, of course, is a very important way in which electromagnetism connects with the real world. Because if you have a force on a wire, you can now do mechanical things by moving currents and wires inside of magnetic fields and get things to move. So here's one example. Where suppose we have a current loop, so it's just a rectangular loop, which is in a plane that's off at some angle here with respect to the x and z axes. And it's 5 centimeters this way and 10 centimeters that way, and the current goes around as we're currently looking at it. In a clockwise direction, and it's free to rotate about the y-axis. And if we were to look at this from above, let's say that we have a magnetic field directly to the right, the question that I wanted to ask is, what is the torque on this loop? Right, so we just have this current-carrying loop, and you have a magnetic field, and you ask, what is the torque on it? And I could imagine, if I'd had a lot of fun last night and I'm falling asleep out there, I might think, why do I actually give a crap about torque on this current-carrying loop? And the reason that you really want to give a crap about this is because, well, there are probably lots of reasons, but one of the most important ones is that atoms are made up of little current loops, basically. The electrons you can think of as doing this. And if you apply a magnetic field, you can produce a torque on this. Now, it becomes complicated by quantum mechanics, but you can basically set up a magnetic field looking at a sample which will actually cause a torque on this current-carrying loop. Quantum mechanically, it will actually resonate and flip at a certain magnetic field, or depending on its exact energy distribution. So what that means is that you can take a magnetic field and a source of energy which can cause this thing to flip when the magnetic field gives. Never try to explain nuclear magnetic resonance on the fly in 20 seconds or less. Okay? That doesn't work too well. You can imagine if I have a little current loop. Boy, I'm way ahead of myself what I wanted to say. Let's just wipe this. Basically, this idea is you have current loops, you can put a torque on them, you can cause them to flip at certain frequencies. You can use this as a diagnostic to understand very well the environment in which this thing sits. We're going to come back to that, but I want to get a little bit more under our belt, and we will talk about magnetic resonance. But I realized as I got halfway into that, there are a few pieces that I had not really we weren't ready for yet. So at any rate, let's take this basic mechanical loop, and I'd like to just figure out what is the torque if we now look at this from above, and this is the y-axis is penetrating our eyeball, for example. What we want to do is to see what is the torque on this thing from above. And so remember that torque is R cross F, right, where R is is the distance from the axis of rotation, and F is the force on. So if we look at this, if the current is going straight up and B is going this way, then we have B up, curl into B, the force is actually down along the axis. That's not going to cause a torque around that axis. If we look at this piece, the force, the V is going down, curl it into B. Did I screw up a moment ago? Which piece was I looking at? I'm sorry. So we have V up, curl B. Actually, I'm sorry. The force is into the board. So let me rewrite this. Yeah, I think I said something wrong a second ago. So here is our piece. And let us consider this piece right here. So we have I going up. We have B to the right. So V cross B is into the board. So we're going to have F at this point is going to be in. For this piece, we have I coming down. Like so. We have B to the right. So I cross B cross B is straight out at you. So in this case, F is coming out at you. Up on the top, I is like this. And so we have I coming out, crossing in to B is going to be a force up, and on the bottom we have I going this way, cross into B is a force going down. So up here we have F going up, and down here we have F going down. All right, now if what you're trying to do is to figure out the torque around this axis, this force is irrelevant because it's going through the axis. This force and that force, first of all, they'll cancel each other out by symmetry, but second of all, they are parallel to the axis, so you won't get a torque. Torque is only has to do with the force around the axis. So it's only this piece that we need to worry about. So if we now look at this situation from above, here's the Z axis, here's the X axis, here's the angle theta, which is this opening angle here. And then here is the piece, it is this piece of the loop is what we see going straight into the board right here. This force is this force coming straight down. It's going to be parallel to the Z axis, just like we have drawn. If you can juggle your point of view between these different slides, I hope you can realize that this is going to be the direction of F on that piece of the, on this piece of the wire. And if this is angle theta, then that is angle theta. This piece that is at right angles to the line from the point of rotation to the point where the force is applied is projected out by F cosine theta. So it's this blue vector right here. So the torque is going to be R times this F cosine theta. F is going to be I times this length times B. So the torque is equal to R cross F, and that's going to end up being R times F cosine theta. That basically takes the cross product, and then it's going to be times I times L times B, where L is the 10 centimeters bit. And the direction of it now, you're going to rotate the thing in the direction of the force. So R cross F gives you something that's going to be down in the negative Z direction. All right, so it can, of course, get awful because you now get this full-blown mechanics problem in sort of 3D and have to untangle everything. And this is just sort of a painful reminder of how that can be. If on a test or whatever you want to be reminded of what torque is or things like that, I may put it on the formula sheet or I'll tell you. Okay, this is an electromagnetism course. I don't have a problem reminding you of what things are mechanically. But if you have a hole and don't remember what torque is and stuff like that, then you'll want to fill that. Any questions on this type of thing? Okay. So recall that way back when we started out with electrostatics, we looked at the electric field or the electric force at some distance in space away from a charge. So if we have a charge Q, which is at some vector R away from a point P, then we said that there was an electric field, which was K times Q over R squared in the R hat direction. And the force was equal to the charge. If you ask what is the force on a little charge Q placed at P, it is going to be that charge Q times the electric field, and it's in the same direction as the force. We also looked at a discrete distribution of charges, and we generalized it to a continuous distribution of charge. So if I have some continuous distribution of charge and I have the origin sort of where I show it, then you can imagine having a little differential piece of charge given at a vector r away from the origin. I'll call that r prime. And we add a point P outside of that charge distribution, which is at a vector R away from the origin. Then we have, from the little differential charge, we have this r minus r prime vector. And once we have that geometry all set up, we can write down, so basically the idea is to take this, you can write down the differential piece using what we know from Coulomb's law, the differential electric field at point P from that little dq is going to be k times dq over this distance, r minus r prime squared. And it'll be in the r minus r prime direction, which is given by the hat. So this you've all seen before. Okay, I just want to remind you of that. Because what I want to do next is now show you the analogous thing for magnetism. So this is, of course, what we call Coulomb's law. In magnetostatics, that basically means you have currents that are not changing. And in magnetostatics, we have what is known as the law of Biot-Savart. And the way this works, if we have a discrete charge Q, which is moving with a velocity V in this direction, and we have a point P that is somewhere out in space, that is specified at this very instant in time by a vector r, then the law of Biot-Savart tells us that B at point P due to Q, to big Q, is equal to mu 0 over 4 pi times Q times V cross R over R squared. What is mu 0? Mu 0 is the magnetic equivalent of epsilon naught that you've seen. We call it, it's a constant, and we call it the permeability of free space. And because writing mu is too simple, or taking mu and making it a number is too simple, a simple number, here is how mu is usually given. This is equal to 4 pi times 10 to the minus 7 Tesla meters per amp. Isn't that nice? Now, you probably are getting used to seeing lots of 4 pi's. So clearly, this 4 pi is usually written this way because it turns out to simplify things often when you're doing your calculations, because it will cancel with other 4 pi's and things, okay? So that's why you write it in this absolutely perverse way. But this is what mu zero is. Also, remember with epsilon naught, we called it the permittivity of free space. And when we were dealing with electric fields in materials, we were able to adjust for that by using different permittivities. So we used an epsilon. Here we can play the same game. We're going to have permeability of free space. So for magnetic field and free space, if you now take the magnetic field and put it in a material, it will get messed up. And when it does, we will use a permeability of the material, because it's going to depend on the material. Now the thing is, this law of Biot-Savart, as is written, is not particularly useful, because it isn't that often that you're going to be worrying about the magnetic field of a particular charge. And in fact, I say this is magnetostatics, and then I immediately underneath it write something that's clearly not going to be magnetostatic, in the sense that it's going to change with time dramatically, because this vector r relative to that q is going to change both in direction and in magnitude immediately, right? Because this is only true at an instant. So this is just complete crap. So what you want to do is actually, you may have to deal with this some, but the form that you're usually using is a form where we have some current I, and I would like to look at a differential piece of that current, so let us consider a little dl along that current. Now, here's where earlier where I talked about the force on a line current. This is the kind of place where you get confusion, right? We have a current going this way. We want to consider a little piece of that current, a little dl. We're going to need to use the vector piece. Whether you sort of think of this as a length dl and an I current in this direction where the I is a vector, or whether you think of I as a magnitude and dl as a vector, so that this little length also has a direction in the direction of I, it's going to be an either-or thing, and you'll just have to figure out what works in your head. But let us consider we have this current, and I would like to consider a little di worth of that. And let's ask, outside of a current, some point P way out here, which is given at a position defined by a vector. Okay, I need to redo this because I don't want to make it look like it's at right angles necessarily. It could be at any position in space. So let's put it up here. No, that's going to go through my eye. too close. Okay, so still going to look a little bit like it's at right angles, so sorry, not necessary. So we have vector r here to point p. Now, you can think of this little dl and its current as a q times a v, right? This is a differential charge moving at a certain velocity, so you can sort of think of that as a little differential piece of current. So if you keep in mind this form of b is mu 0 over 2i times this qv, which is sort of a current piece, cross r over r squared. We're going to write that same form in a differential way now, using idl as our little current. So the differential magnetic field at point P due to this differential piece of current is going to be equal to mu 0 over 4 pi times idl, which I'll call the dl piece of vector in this case, cross r hat over r squared. Now, yeah, that's what I was just thinking. I've got an error in one of those. I believe the true form is over r squared. So I believe this one is an r hat. But let me verify that, okay, and I'll correct the notes. It does fall off as 1 over r squared, so I think that almost has to be the misprint that I've got. You can write it in terms of r, but then you should have v cross r, and it should be over r cubed. And I don't like to write it that way because it's deceptive. It makes you feel like it's falling off as the cube, but it doesn't. It falls off as the magnitude of r squared. But you do have to have the directional piece in it. So just like we've done with all of our current distributions, if you ask now what is the magnetic field at point P, that's mu 0 over 4 pi, and now what you do is you integrate over your current distribution, whatever it is. So you can imagine having some weird distribution of current, right? You could have a wire here and a wire there and a wire here, all with constant current, and you have to integrate over all those. Or you could have like this cylindrical distribution of charge moving this way with some distribution in radius here. Okay, so there's lots of ways to create charge distribution or current distributions. And so this is sort of Coulomb's law for magnetism. So you integrate over the current distribution, the IDL cross r hat over r squared. And that's the thing that is your usual starting place for these types of problems. Given any sort of constant current distribution, you can use this to calculate the magnetic field at any point in space. And you can imagine that, if anything, this is going to be even more painful and tedious in some ways than you had with Coulomb's law, because now you've got this awful cross product and you're the 1 over r squared. So you're having to deal with direction and the cross product, and it's 1 over r squared. So it's clearly, you know, there will have to be very particular geometries that you can use. This is an example of something where in your preparations for exams, you should look and think systematically at the certain geometries where this is a doable problem, because I can guarantee you there are lots of geometries where this really isn't going to be something that's doable. Any questions on that? So the next thing I wanted to do was an example, but I don't have time to actually do it, so I'm not going to start it. So we're done. See you Thursday. Remember to figure out which groups you want to do.